Today on the Rising Coaches Podcast.
The nebulous nature of the relationship between an agent and a player. Are you his boss? Is he your boss? Which he is, technically. But you're sort of giving leadership and guidance. They're relying on you to do a lot of things where their level of education has to catch up to their talent. So first-year player is not going to be able to make the same level of decision or incorporate as much of what is going on industry-wise into his personal situation.
Today's podcast is brought to you by the Rising Coaches Association, the biggest coaching tree in all of basketball. Sign up for the Rising Coaches Association now for just $120 a year and become part of our community, relationships, and development. We talk about it all the time. There's no straight lines in this profession. There's only ups and downs. You need a community that knows exactly what you're going through and has been there before to help lean on during the rough times of the industry. You need genuine relationships, not just exchanging numbers, not just meeting new people at the Final Four in the off season. You should be doing it all year round, and we provide tremendous opportunities to create those genuine relationships all through the year. And finally, development. We have so much content and so many resources so that you can work on your craft and become a better coach. Because we put such a premium and an emphasis on helping you establish new, genuine relationships, it takes all of the political BS side of the business out of the equation for you. All of that gets removed off of your plate. You can just worry about being you, making new friends in the business, and working on your craft and becoming the best coach that you can be and impacting the people that you're around on a daily basis. For more information, visit risingcoaches.com/membership on risingcoaches.com. Okay, and we're live here on the Rising Coaches Podcast, joined today by Andy Miller. We appreciate you guys tuning in. It's a big day. Of course, Andy Miller, longtime agent, joins us now. And then in about an hour, we'll kick off the day four of the Rising Coaches Conference on Zoom for members. So we encourage you, there's still time. Go to the website, risingcoaches.com. You can sign up for a free trial and attend the entire week of content. You can go back and watch anything you've missed. Tonight we have Buzz Williams of Texas A&M. So lots of great stuff in store. And let's get right to it. Andy, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you, and thanks for having me. I when I hear Buzz Williams and some of the other people that have been on this show and been a part of this, I'm humbled to be asked to visit with you today and all the followers. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, there's very few people, non-coach, non-athlete, that have had as big of an impact on the game as you have.
Well, Adam, I have to correct you there. I don't know if I'm a non-athlete. In my own mind, I was once a great athlete, but I can't say that anyone else would agree. But, okay, if you want to call me a non-athlete, I ran a 6:33 mile on the treadmill the other day, and I really was proud of myself. But being 50 years old has its liability. So I'll take non-athlete for the time being.
Hey, that's a pretty good time on the treadmill there.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I don't think I could do that.
Well, I'm proud of that. That's why I put it out there now.
Well, you joked about it, but you said you were an athlete growing up. Yeah. Tell us about your background. How did you get into sports? Did you always want to be an agent? You know, what was your background?
Well, unfortunately, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, obviously making me 50. But back then there really wasn't any agent industry or anyone to follow or model at all. I just grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey, where, there were a lot of great athletes and you grew up around sports, and sports pretty much dominated everyone's life. And so I grew up around basketball and football for the majority of my time. And, I happened to be a decent football player. So it was an opportunity for me going through high school to, look at different colleges and have an opportunity to visit with colleges regarding the football component. But, while I was doing that in the early 80s, I knew I wanted to be an agent. I don't know why. It was sort of an epiphany. There wasn't an industry at the time. Lawyers were representing unions. So I did some, they weren't called internships then, more volunteer work, working for different lawyers that represented a referee union or a coaches union in a high school area. and collated paper. That was before Xerox machines as well. So I got a little bit of experience of it in the early 80s. And then there were two colleges that it came down to for me. One was Delaware and one was UMass. UMass was at the early stages of its sports management program, which is obviously a humongous program. And you know, obviously the people that have come through that over the years have really benefited from the platform that they provide. Delaware didn't have a program, but I ended up going there. It was the biggest 1AA school in the country. And I just thought that it would be a good place for me to go just because I was enamored with the school. But, you know, looking back on the experience, I think I maximized it. It's one of the things I want to talk about today. After a year of playing football and realizing I wasn't good enough to play 1AA and I was a 7-string quarterback, the academic advisor asked me if I wanted to be their guinea pig and make up a major, sports management major, and they could use me to kind of guideline a platform for them to develop the sports management major. But for me, it would have been an opportunity to gain experience. So I stayed at the school. I stopped playing football. And for 3 years, I just focused in on gathering as much information around the business as I possibly could. So that's how I sort of found my way, by navigating, not knowing where I was going, but navigating by gathering as much information and experience as I possibly could, with it not being necessarily at your fingertips, but being proactive in terms of trying to better yourself in any area you have an opportunity to do so.
Andy, we were talking, I guess, a week or two ago, and we talked about some of the similarities between, you know, being an agent and being a coach. And I think both industries, you know, it is crucial to be able to recruit talent. And I know you get to a point where your reputation, you know, helps you there, but, you know, starting out, you know, what are, you know, how did you find your way recruiting wise?
Yeah. I look at, recruiting as more of a map. You know, and you really have to plant your seeds almost everywhere and have your fingertips in as many areas. You can't specialize and say, well, I'm a good recruiter in the New Jersey area because I know three AAU coaches. You really have to be able to spread your surroundings and make as many contacts as you possibly can, not knowing if they'll ever pay dividends. I think a lot of times what happens with coaches and along with agents with recruiting is it's sort of target recruiting. You know, you develop a relationship with someone for the purpose of this, and it's isolated and hollow. I always have taken a long-term approach. Building relationships with people shouldn't be about the benefit of one opportunity or one recruit. And over the years that I was representing players, I would have AAU coaches that I had relationships with that may or may not have been a very strong program, but I'd stayed in contact with them and continued to support them in terms of building relationships with them and communicating with them and making them feel as if they're part of, you know, whatever we were accomplishing as a group, as an agency. And I always viewed it as a family in that regard. And with family, obviously you don't pick and choose, you more or less incorporate. And, you know, I always felt that that was the best way to create and manufacture dividends, is to kind of keep everyone in the loop and everyone incorporated. I always felt that when you had a target recruit, it was a crapshoot. And I never wanted to recruit under those circumstances. But as you said, the better you get at it and the more success you have, the more able you are to do target recruiting. But I always felt that you cannot never leave. And this also goes for negotiating. You can never leave a situation where people feel like they're being used for a one-off. And for me, that was what recruiting was all about, was just generating as many contacts and network opportunities as possible, never knowing where I was going to leave, but knowing at some point either I'm going to pay a dividend to them and there would be some level of reciprocity, or they would pay a dividend to me and then there would be some other level of reciprocity with regard to doing business with each other down the line.
And then I imagine along those lines, whether the situation works out or not, you probably never burn a bridge, right? You always stay in contact. And
well, you try to. I mean, obviously, things don't always go as planned. But I think it's important when you talk about bridge burning and bridge building, it's important to always be honest. And a lot of times in this business, there's a lot of frustration. You know, timing plays a pivotal role. There's a lot of pressure. There's a finite amount of opportunity and roles available, so there's a lot of pressure on everyone in terms of what one move can do and sort of the resonation or ripple effect it could have. But you try not to burn bridges, and the best way to accomplish that is to just have open communication, be honest all the time. It's sometimes very uncomfortable and awkward. And, you know, obviously two people in any partnership will approach a situation with a different interpretation. There has to be a meeting of the minds. Unfortunately, there's divorce, there's separation, there's, you know, all kinds of things that could happen within personal relationships and professional ones. And you try to avoid that the best that you can. But I think that when you have an outlook that the long term is the sort of the baseline of how you make decisions, ultimately, you're going to be successful more than you're going to fail in those in the concept of relationship building and failing.
So, Andy, we kind of mentioned you've been doing this for over 20 years at this point, and clearly the game's changed a lot, sure. Right? So what's been some of the biggest ways that the industry's changed?
Yeah, well, for me, and I struggle with this because it's not really my area of expertise. I'm more of a dinosaur. I think that most of the followers that are listening and supporting of Rising Coaches probably find this to be more of something of a comfort level or organic. And that's social media. You know, it didn't exist when I first got into business, and it's prevalent now. It plays a significant role. You know, one of the premise of operating as an agent, whether it's representing players or front office and coaches, has always been that in this industry in particular, I can't speak to any other, but in this industry, perception is many times greater than reality. And so in this business now, today, perception is somewhat manipulated and shaped by social media. And, you know, you have to be able to adjust with the times and be aware of it and understand that the level of how information is disseminated and communicated is at a speed that many years ago didn't exist. So you have to stay on top of that as the best that you can. But the business has also become so much more saturated in a positive way. It's created more job opportunity because when I first got into the business as an agent, you know, I did all the PR and the marketing and the negotiating and the recruiting, and you just can't stay on top of everything. So you really do need to have a support staff and have people around that are not only experts in one area, but are multi-talented and multifaceted in what they can contribute. But I would have to say social media has played the biggest role, and its reverberation of what it means and how you have to account for it has changed immeasurably.
Have you embraced that? Can we find you on TikTok? And
No, I have not embraced it. I am someone that on occasion I have had my TikTok account set up, and I am more of a voyeur in that regard, mostly in the venue of sports. You know, I follow a lot of sports that are posted mostly, and all kidding aside, I think that TikTok is a fascinating platform. I have watched and followed both through my kids and just monitoring it myself, that evolution over the last year and how people are making money and how people are marketing through it. I think that it's a fascinating platform that is now being utilized. It wasn't here a year ago. I have an account on Instagram and on Twitter, but I don't post. Probably, again, I'm more of a dinosaur. It would be more useful. I'll give advice to many clients. I've done a lot of broadcasting contracts as well over the last couple of years, and I'll say to them, we have to raise your threshold with the amount of followers you have across your social media platform. I think that's a priority nowadays. But I haven't mastered for myself how to utilize it, to be quite frank, because a lot of things that go on in the agent business in terms of how you operate and also how you comport yourself and philosophically how you approach the marketplace. For me in particular, I like to be an operator from behind the scenes, not necessarily doing anything that would warrant it. It's just where my comfort level is rather than being out in front. I also think that in my particular situation, I can avoid social media as my personal platform because my relationship with media across the nation and globally is strong. I've developed those relationships. I have people that I feel comfortable with that I can communicate with both on and off the record. And the media component of our industry is another area where there is much a viable part of the contributions and results of what goes on in the industry as a coach, as an agent, as anyone else that would be a contributor to the the net results of what the players do.
Okay. A few years ago, you pivoted. You started your career representing mostly players. And just recently, you pivoted to representing coaches. What's the biggest, difference between, serving those two different clientele?
Yeah, for me, the transition was very organic. Many of the, having been an agent for over 20 years, many of the players that I represented during their cycle as players, they were cycling out and becoming front office people. And I had already done some transitional work, whether it was Andre Patterson, who's now an executive with the Cleveland Cavaliers, or Chauncey Billups, Tyronn Lue, Tayshaun Prince. So I had the opportunity to have a little bit of a head start with that core industry of representation of front office and coaches. I had a little bit of a glimpse into it. It's a different industry in that you're not as much of a contributor in the development of the client. You're more a strategic partner of theirs. You're not as much. I think the nebulous nature of the relationship between an agent and a player. Are you his boss? Is he your boss? Which he is technically, but you're sort of giving leadership and guidance. They're relying on you to do a lot of things where their level of education has to catch up to their talent. So first year player is not going to be able to make the same level of decision or incorporate as much of what is going on industry wise into his personal situation, whereby coaches and front office people, for the most part, have more of a 360 perspective of what's going on. Now, the difference with coaches and front office people, depending upon their level of experience and their network base, is that there's, as I like to label it, there's different rungs of their level of information and intel. And so that plays a significant role in how you partner up with them and help strategically move their career along. Versus players, for the most part, you have to, create their marketplace, you have to help them develop, and then you have to be their spokesperson and mouthpiece. You really don't partner up with a player in that you are sort of a 1-2 step on how to get their marketplace and negotiate a contract. The onus completely falls on your shoulders. In their particular silos, both the player and the front office / coach, they contribute to their own careers in different ways. I find that the coaches and the front office people to be much more proactive in their own learning curves, not settling on what their skill set might be for today. So, for example, if a coach gets labeled as an offensive coach, he has to develop a myriad of skill set in order to be well-rounded, because if his ultimate goal is to be a head coach, he can't be labeled as an offensive coach. So I'm not going to be able to provide defensive schemes for him, but that he'll study. But he will find network people in his industry that he feels comfortable he can rely on or gather more intel or information to educate himself along the way. Players are a little bit different. They're going to have trainers, or you're going to provide trainers for them, and they're going to sort of maximize their skill set. But once they maximize their skill set, they've pretty much reached their pinnacle of their industry. And then it's how you manage them and sort of maximize that. So it's a different sort of contributory factor to how they develop in the industry. But it's been a fascinating experience for me. I've enjoyed it immensely. I do enjoy, I still have very strong relationships with a lot of the players that I've represented that are still in the league. But I have to say that I've enjoyed the aspect of representing coaches and front office people a little bit more, because you're dealing with more or less your peer group. So there's more of a connection that way. I kind of felt that as a player's agent, you go through different stages. When I was toward the latter part of my career, I realized that even though I thought I was young, being 45, 46, I didn't have the same connectivity with the players anymore. They looked at me as a power player more so than their confidant. And so how you manage them has to evolve and change. And I think that plays a pivotal role in how you present yourself, how you market yourself, and how you utilize recruiting from different standpoint. Versus, when you're dealing with coaches and front office people, for the most part, who I am and how I represent you is not going to change. It's going to stay static, because they're going to change and they need someone who's going to provide them with a certain level of expertise while they're evolving. You don't have to evolve with them. I really never got to the stage where I was a father figure to a lot of players. Thankfully, I lost a lot of hair along the way, and it hadn't grayed out completely, but I never got to that stage, thankfully, because that would have been a humbling experience. So I always viewed myself more as the uncle or the big brother. And you have to approach things a little bit differently when you're coming from a different lens.
Yeah, absolutely. What should coaches be doing more of? Like, where are they? I always think it's a hard balance between, you know, getting yourself, your brand out there, and also like self-promoting or being
right.
being labeled as too aggressive there. So like, you know, what do you recommend to your clients in that regard?
You know, I always rely on focusing on the job at hand. There's two components of it. How good a coach are you and how diverse is your coaching style? You know, what makes you a better coach or unique in the job that you're doing? And I do believe that networking is important, but when it's done under the auspice of trying to advance your career, it has a certain level of artificial implementation to it versus, you know, I'll recommend to people during the course of their off season to go reach out and speak to different people. And maybe it's to talk about offense or defense or special teams or with front office people, you know, talk to other people about cap or outside the industry, speak to people about different types of deals, but really work your network base for purposes other than just to get a job. You know, I always find it fascinating that, you know, we talked about the speed in which information is disseminated. I'll use Chauncey as an example. When his name came up with the Indiana Pacers as a head coach and that he was a candidate, the amount of phone calls I got that day and Chauncey got that day with people soliciting to get a job, I always find that to be 3 to 4 rungs away from the core audience of what you're doing. They have no chance of getting a job, not because I don't like them or because they may not be skilled people that are calling Chauncey or myself, but because the wheels have been in motion for so long. Chauncey already knows who he wants on a staff should he get a job. Now, it may change or be altered somewhat, but you can't start to network the minute that someone has something that you want to be a part of or attach yourself to. It really has an artificial ring to it. And the more sophisticated you get in the business, the more you realize who has authenticity. And I kind of believe that, you know, developing your own skill set and being recognized with patience. And a lot of people are worried about making it to the next step too quickly. And this is a longevity type business. I know it's one of the things that I get asked all the time is, you know, what is some of the advice or the best advice you've received? And, you know, I think this goes hand in hand with this, you know, question or line of question is that you chose to be in this business. You know, this is a business that you have to have for passion and you have to do with longevity. And you may never achieve your goals, but you chose this because it's something that makes you happy every morning that you wake up. If it doesn't, you shouldn't be in it. But if you're going to get frustrated because you're an assistant coach and you're not being recognized, you're not moving up the ladder, I've had a lot of coaches that I've given advice to prior to being on this side and also while being on this side. Those are the coaches that never have any success. They wallow in sort of a trail where they're just sort of on a treadmill, more or less, rather than sort of soaking in the experience they've had, understanding that they're in a better position today than they were yesterday because yesterday they weren't. Today they have a job and tomorrow they could be out of a job. And yesterday they were building up to today. If you take that kind of approach and you just worry about accomplishing a job, your hand and having success, it's not a always me type industry. There's a lot of people that like to be sitting in your position, whatever that might be. But I just believe that, you know, working on your own skill set and maybe recognizing your blind spots and doing an over-exaggerated effort to sort of educate yourself in those areas to be as well-rounded as you could be, networking with authenticity and not worrying about the next job. You know, you'll get recognized as long as you latch on to the right people for the right reasons.
Okay, this is the Rising Coaches Podcast presented by Lucio Sports. Check out luciosports.com. Go to the App Store and download their Assist app or their Whiteboard app, or join Rising Coaches and get both of those apps for free, where you can diagram plays, create your own personal knowledge library. It's all secure. You can share it with your staff, with your athletes. Some unbelievable resources there at Lucio Sports. We are joined here today by agent Andy Miller. Andy, you kind of touched on it a little bit there, but obviously in the coaching industry, there is a lot of turnover. Mm-hmm. If you coach long enough, you are going to find yourself out of a job. So what should we be doing at that point? If you find yourself in that situation, What do you recommend to your clients?
Well, depending upon the timeline of it and, you know, where you are in terms of your evolution with your network base, I think it becomes a little bit organic in that you're calling the people that are in within your wheelhouse, not outside. Sometimes they're networking for you saying, hey, I have a job, but this is a guy that I'd recommend for you. You know, so if it's outside the immediate circle of contact, I think a lot of times with that, when you're calling and soliciting for new opportunity, you better make sure that you're not calling and saying, hey, I want to be a coach on your staff. You better be bringing opportunity. You better be bringing different concept. When you call someone and you're asking or soliciting an opportunity, you can't do that in the context of saying, hey, can you give me something? You better be bringing something that you're giving if you want reciprocity, because that person that has leverage doesn't need you. They've got 100 of you calling. So you have to come with something. So if you're calling a head coach and saying, hey, you know, I have these five out of bounds plays that I've been working on, you know, these different things that I've been creating and developing with that out of timeouts or baseline opportunities, you know, in terms of out of bounds plays, you know, you've got to bring different things to the table to make yourself valuable. But if you're coming to the table and say, hey, can I have an opportunity to interview with you? What are you differentiating yourself from the next person? Because as you said, this is a saturated industry. It cycles. Everyone gets cycled at some point, so you don't have to get down on yourself. Everyone gets fired at some point. And so it really comes down to the next opportunity. And you have to prepare well for it by when you're sitting in a good position, not sitting on your laurels and not being overconfident. It's always working toward bettering yourself. And the more you do that, and the more you're reaching out to other people and getting more information, sharing information, the more people will know how driven you are. And hopefully it'll be solicitous in that regard rather than you being solicitous. But I do believe that if you do have to be in a position where you get pinned down and you have to solicit for a job because you're in a desperate state, which hopefully it doesn't happen. But if it were to happen, you better make those phone calls with the auspice of I'm bringing something to the table, not my resume, not a network in terms of someone that's saying, hey, let me introduce you, but I have some things on the table I want to bring to you that might help your system. And if we end up working together, great. And if we don't, now I've made an impact on that person that might help me with somewhere else down the line.
We see some comments coming in on social media. Please, if you guys have questions for Andy, drop them in the comments, regardless of the platform that you're watching on. We appreciate you tuning in. Andy, what should coaches really, you know, take into account when they are, you know, exploring a new job? I'm sure with your players that you've represented, you know, you want to look at, you know, how much, you know, the other people at their position, how much opportunity there is to get playing time. For sure. Coaches, it's a little different, right? But there certainly are some things to be on the lookout for.
Yeah, I think that if you have an opportunity and you're being offered a job, you have to look at a number of factors. First, internal rather than external. This is a very difficult industry to balance both your personal and professional life. So you have to weigh them early and we have core values, you know, geographics as it would relate to the family, dynamic as it relate to school for the kids, your wife's level of happiness, especially the amount of time you're going to be away from the house, because all those personal things play a role in your ability to execute and be productive at your job. If they're not factors because you're not married, then you really have more freedom. But either way, I think you have to look at, you know, what are the baseline things? Because there is going to come a time. I had a president of a team once tell me that a player that I had represented that was going to be a head coach, or that he looked to have the prospects and has turned out to be accurate, said to me he doesn't divide his life between basketball and his personal life. And he has to have something to go home to so that at times he can have a separation. Because if you don't have that separation and you're working 19, 20 hours a day, you're not refreshed ever. And so your thoughts and your energy become stagnant. And you can't have that either. So your personal life does play a role. It can't outweigh. Your personal life will never be primary if you're in this industry. But it has to be a strong secondary where everyone is on board and supports that. With that being said, when you're weighing options and opportunities, I think a lot of it, at least in the NBA level, and I could trickle down to college as well, but on the NBA level, the first thing we evaluate is the culture of the franchise and the ownership and how they manage their employees. How well do they treat them? Okay, because that plays a significant role in the business at hand. Is it a team that has a longstanding culture of development and support of their employees, or are they a culture that needs quick turnover because they're always scrapping and fighting to get to the bottom of the better rung? Because those play pivotal roles. Then, you know, I would also evaluate who your direct is, who you're reporting to, and what kind of relationship do you have with that person? What is their reputation? What is their history? Speak to people that have worked for them in the past. What is the level of success of the people that have worked for them? Are they supportive of the people on that staff? And do they not only support them in-house in terms of their development and growth, but they support them to for a succession plan to grow? Or is it very territorial in-house in that regard? Because I think that all those things play a role in the level of success you could have in contributing and producing and also evolving. I have found you'd be surprised that there are territorial aspects to this business beyond what, you know, someone would say is norm. And that is sometimes someone is so successful and so helpful in the job they're doing that the people above them don't want them to leave. So they smother them. I've heard those stories before and I've actually experienced it a little bit. And that's a difficult situation to be in. So you want to make sure that the people that were in that position before, what was the rationale as to why they left? I also think that the level of communication inside an organization is critical, whether that's an organization at the college or pro level. It's all the same because these are all micro businesses, macro at the NBA level with the value of these companies. But, you know, they're all micro businesses in that the basketball operations, whatever their value is in terms of how much money they generate per year, it's what is the executive team and how do they communicate and how do they interact with each other? And what's the culture? Are they friends off the court and outside of the business offices that they operate? I think those all play a role to how well you're going to have an experience and what level of success you're going to have within that experience.
You mentioned the word leverage earlier, and I want to talk more, you know, in terms of like negotiation and the agent side. Enough of the coaching stuff. Give us the key to, you know, a good negotiation and how you get leverage in a situation. Or is that just something that can you manufacture leverage, or is that something that exists on one side or the other?
Sometimes, you know, it's a moving definition, because sometimes it exists organically in a situation where maybe one side covets the other side. And so you have automatic leverage. Sometimes you have to manufacture, and that's where I think strategy plays a pivotal role. Strategy doesn't happen after you get the job. Strategy happens leading into the sort of the steps to get to that job. That's how you create leverage from the outset. I'll give examples in a minute. But also, you have to recognize that with leverage, you have to have humility. So you can't have an ultimate amount of leverage and exercise it to its fullest, because when you do that, you exhaust that. And then you can be rest assured it's going to come back and punch you in the face sometime down the line too. There has to be a certain amount of recognition with leverage that you have to have humility and say, okay, I recognize I have opportunity here and I can create a better situation for myself, but I also have to know when to either stop pushing or concede the pushing so that it creates opportunity down the line, because that's strategy in its own right. If you do that, and you do a good job, well, let's say you leverage a situation, you get an extra X amount of dollars over a 3-year period for a contract, but you could have gotten 2 times that. And you do a great job over those 3 years. You have started the relationship on such a positive note that you might be valued at 3 times that value when that contract expires. So leverage is a moving target. But I've had situations where in the scenarios I've given you, where a team will call and say, we need to have this guy, we want him. And I've used it one of two ways, either creating the best situation for him, where I say, you know, within that negotiation, here are our stop contingencies. It's X amount, these benefits as core benefits, and this role. Okay. But if that doesn't work out, if you can't get the ultimate amount of leverage in that regard where you're leaving some cushion at the top, you can also use that in the boomerang effect, where by creating an opportunity elsewhere, you can always say, you know what, I decided not to take that opportunity, and you go back to the situation you're in and create a better situation there. So it could have a boomerang effect. So leverage can be created not with necessarily new opportunity alone. It could be created by leveraging off of the new opportunity. So leverage is an evolving term, but yeah, that's one way that I've created leverage. And the other one strategically is leading into a possible opportunity. When you know that when an opportunity is going to either present itself or be created for you, is how you take those steps prior to, by sort of carving the niche and solidifying the foundation prior to the negotiation. It's almost like a precursor to a negotiation. And in that regard, you've set the standard in which walking into that negotiation, you already have an upper hand.
Yeah, great stuff. We talked a little bit about recruiting earlier, and that's part number one, you know, get secure talent. And then, you know, probably the hard part is you have to be able to manage talent. How, you know, you've made a career out of that. You know, what are the, you know, keys to it, and how have you been able to manage it in your career? And then maybe give me, you know, on the coach's side, some examples of how you've seen people do it at a high level.
Okay. Well, for me, managing talent is easy for one reason only. I always act and communicate in an honest fashion. A lot of times it doesn't work because people don't want to hear honesty. And so they get mad at you or they resent you for it. But if I've always come with the philosophy and the principle that if I tell you something today, you ask me a question or we're discussing a matter and I tell you something today, no matter when you ask me that same question down the line, whether it's you wake me up at 3 a.m, you catch me off guard, or I'm talking to a third party and they ask me the question for you, I'm always going to answer it the same way because I'm always going to answer it with honesty. That is the baseline for how I've always managed. Again, it doesn't always work. It's not always great with recruiting because sometimes questions are asked. I'll give you an example. I've had in the past, you know, especially with all the solidification and power of .com, where parents will look at the .com draft charts and say, well, my son is projected to go, I don't know, 50. And a lot of agents are saying they can make him into a first round pick. You know, we're calling you because you have leverage and whatever, you know, accolades or kudos they bestow. Can you make him into a first round pick? And my response in those situations, as long as it's the right and appropriate one, is the fact that you're projected to be 50 on this.com does not necessarily mean that that's the peak. I mean, the nadir, it could be the peak. You could end up going undrafted. So you're coming to me asking me to get you drafted higher. What if you get drafted lower or go undrafted? Now, a lot of people don't like to hear that. Well, there's a tendency in this business when you're managing that you have to recognize that it's not just in our industry, it's just a human factor. But in our industry, we have a tendency to give ourselves the worst case scenario as an analysis, which to others isn't a worst case scenario. It may be the best case scenario. And so in managing people, I've always felt that it's imperative to not only recognize where they see the status at, wherever they're getting their information, whether it be from other people or from social media, but recognizing that analysis of where they are, but also recognizing the upside that they're, you know, sort of hoping for, and giving them scenarios of how realistic that may be, or how, if it is realistic, how we can get there, but also manufacturing a platform of what worst case scenarios could be, so they have the widest spectrum possible. And to me, that is the key to managing, is giving the client or the recruit the best case scenario. And you hear the cliches when people are recruiting, I'm not going to promise you a starting role. You got to give them a broader base than just that. And I'm sure it's much more in depth with the followers that are listening today and coaches in general. But you really have to give a very broad base when you're managing, and you have to be consistent, and you have to always be communicative, and you have to manage not only for the minute, but for the hour, for the day, for the week, for the month. And you always have to be coming up with new ideas and new, and be creative, so that they know that you're always thinking about them and you're always trying to develop and help them and contribute to their success.
Yeah, that's great. Andy, you're clearly gifted in communication. You seem very comfortable in your own skin and just like you are who you are. Where do those, or you are who you are, did I say that right? Where do those come from for you, like those traits? Is that something you think you were born with? Did you develop them along the way?
You know, I when I was at the University of Delaware, I well, after I made up the major, I was able to bounce around a little bit and gain a lot of experience because, again, they didn't have any classes. And one of the things I was able to do, and a lot of people on this call can relate to it, is they didn't have, there was a low D1 at the time, and they actually went to their first NCAA tournament when I was there. But I volunteered as sort of a manager slash coach. Now, I had no interest in being a coach at the time, and I still don't want to be in the coaching realm, but I was there to sort of help them from a business standpoint. So I put together their itineraries, their budgets for travel. I sat in the basketball office, helped them with recruiting letters and such. I really wasn't as interested in being on the court. And one day there was some sort of breakout on the court, and I happened to be there on the sidelines talking to the head coach. And, a player fell and there was a sweat mark on the floor. And there was no managers at the time. And someone said, the head coach, who wasn't the nicest guy, but, you know, he's a very stern person, said to me, get a towel, clean that up. And I looked at him and I'm thinking to myself, I'm not the manager. I'm not cleaning up sweat. I'm not a coach. And before I could even finish thinking that and communicating that without sounding like, an a-hole, one of the assistants, the top assistant, grabbed the towel, wiped it up, and got off the court. No one made fun. I was afraid of being made fun of or thought of in less of a, cool way, or, being friendly with the players. And I realized then, this is when I was maybe 20 or 21, that if you take pride in what you do and you're confident in the way you do it with humility, then there really isn't anything that anyone can say to you or do to you that your pride or ego can be offended. And I don't worry about those things. I worry about delivering and communicating and producing. And so being comfortable in my own skin means that I'm not worried about being embarrassed. I'm not driven by that. I'm not driven by what other people think. I'm driven by my commitment and my partnership to my clients and driving their business and the opportunities that they've given me in terms of representing them. And I find that to be an honor, because they could choose a lot of other people. So being comfortable in my own skin means that I'm comfortable communicating. You may not like everything I'm saying today. You may think I'm boring. You may think I'm not handsome and we should have put some garters up on the screen. And people that are listening may say, I've heard about Andy Miller. I've heard good things. I've heard bad. It doesn't matter. Because the people that I represent, that I've contributed to, and the people that I deal with, that I'm committed to, know who I am. I am not the nicest guy in the world, and I'm not the meanest guy in the world. I view myself in being one of the – I try to be most honorable and honest person to whomever I'm dealing with. And so that, in that regard, being comfortable in your own skin is pretty easy, to be quite frank.
Oh, got it. Sorry. That was such a great answer. I love that. You mentioned work-life balance for your clients. I'm just curious how you kind of manage that. Obviously you've had a ton of success in your career. How have you kind of walked that tightrope in work-life balance?
I've walked that tightrope. I can't say I balance it, and I'm not saying I'm an expert and would give anyone else advice on it. I think it really comes down to the dynamic of your family and how they adjust. I was saying to I have three children, and I was saying to my middle daughter the other day, she had a problem with her tennis, with a match that she had, with the partner she had. She wanted advice on how to speak with the coach, and she gave me her play act of how she was going to talk to the coach. And I said to her, I don't agree with that. I said, you've been raised in a sports family. You should know better. That's not how you approach a coach. I think that my family, I've tried to teach them the principles and the honor of being in this business and having a certain level of success, but not having them being neck deep in the industry, having their independence, not being a basketball family. My son plays basketball, but it's probably his third best sport. I don't think he's great at any one sport, but he tries hard in all of them. But basketball is probably the one he's least successful at. My daughters do not play basketball. My oldest one did. Growing up, if they brought them to games or brought them to meetings, if that was need be, it wasn't to see a game. They were not fans. It was because of the relationships I had with certain clients, and they respect that. So if I missed something and I was borne by my own Jewish guilt by not being able to attend an event here or there, I was always called by one of my children saying, "Don't worry, Dad, we understand," and giving me some relief. So I was, I think that I've been fortunate in that my kids have been supportive in that regard and recognize that everything I do not necessarily for them, because I think that's more of a cliche, not true. I've done that because I wanted to be successful in this industry and I've been committed to it, and it makes me who I am today. I don't think that I'm driven by one being one of those fathers and husbands that punches a clock 9 to 5 and is defined by the husband and father I am. I'm defined by the businessman I am, and how I incorporate the two bifurcated worlds I live in, and the best in doing the best that you can with them. It's not easy, and I've made a lot of mistakes along the way, and you try and make up for those mistakes the best you can. But you know, you just have to be as cognizant as you can. You know, one of the things that my family knows is that if I were to give up this industry tomorrow and do something else, I probably wouldn't be Andy Miller who I am today. And that's who they've grown to either respect, love, and get frustrated with from time to time. But certainly I'm theirs. You know, to do something else would not be authentic to who I am. It would sort of mollify who I am as a person. So I need this industry as much as they benefit from it. So I think it's a unilateral relationship in that regard. But again, that goes back to when you're balancing those things, I think you have to recognize if you choose to be in this industry and your family, if you're married and or with a young family or an older family or whatever age group family you have, they have to be committed to it as well. Otherwise, you're going to be fighting against two odds, your ability to be successful in this industry and your family allowing you to be successful. I'll give you one example. I used to send players overseas early in my career, and I developed a division that did that over time. And so I didn't have as much contact to it, but I did always give advice when a player was shipping off to go overseas, if they were married or if they had a girlfriend or a significant other that was going with them. And I would always say, why don't you get adjusted over there first before you send for them? Because a lot of times what happened is you go to a foreign country. This is just an easy example. You go to a foreign country, it takes you time to adjust. You've never lived in a foreign country before. You may be fascinated by the experience, maybe a learned soul, but it still takes time to adjust. And you bring someone else over there who doesn't have a job, who doesn't have anything to do for themselves. They're sitting in their flat waiting for you to come home from practice every day. So it adds a level of pressure for you to not get extra shots up, to not want to spend time with your teammates, because you know you have someone waiting at home that if they're miserable and unhappy, you're trying to pacify them when they're not supportive of your goal because they don't have anything else going. So if it was an insistent of bringing that significant other with them, we'd always try and find something for them to do, whether it's teaching English to foreign people or, you know, making sure they had a workout facility close by, things for them to do that were part of their interest level. So they have their own life of things to do for a couple hours a day so that you can be committed to your life as well. And I think as you expand on that in every aspect or any aspect of what you do in this industry, you have to recognize if you're successful in this industry, it's because of the hard work you put in and the support you get.
Andy, that reminds me of an episode of Finding Mastery podcast. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but he interviewed the former CEO of AT&T, and they asked him about work-life balance. And his answer is very similar to what you just said. There is no such thing as balance. There's only guilt
right.
And how you deal with that.
Right. So that's much more eloquent than the way I said it and probably right to the point, but yes.
No, I love the examples you give. It's so true. Okay. Last question for you, Andy. It all comes down to what?
I think perseverance, consistency, control over, you know, your patience and focus. You know, there's going to be, I even to this day, you know, there are days that I'm working on a couple deals and I get done with 15 hours of calls and I go, you know, I'm a big cigar smoker. I'll go outside and I'll go to smoke a cigar and I'll say, holy Christ, this was a rough day and I'm tired and I have nothing to produce, nothing that I've produced during that day that I could say this was a productive day. And you just have to get after it every single day with relentless focus and energy and not worry about all the side noise. The side noise in our business is relentless and all it does is decapitate you from reaching your goals. And so I've never worried about when people ask me about, well, what were your goals in 5 years? What were your goals in 10 years? I worried about what my goal was 5 minutes from today, 5 minutes from now. I never worried about long-term goals and you know, business plans. I worried about grinding it on a minute-by-minute, day-by-day basis. And I enjoyed it. I mean, yes, there are aspects of it that I don't enjoy and haven't and won't. But you get through those too, because everything you have to do with a grain of salt. For every 4 a.m. wake up call to get on a 6 o'clock flight, and there's been thousands of them, you know, and you're tired, you get the job done that day because that's what you have to do. There's no excuse. No excuse, because if you don't do it, someone else will. And so you have to be driven every single day without any excuses, because no one cares what your excuses are. A job has to be done. And if you don't do it, someone else will, without excuse. So you have to stay focused every day and grind it out.
Andy, thank you so much for hanging out with us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Great interview. Yeah, we appreciate it. And for everybody tuning in about 15 minutes, a little less, we'll be jumping over to Zoom for day 4 of the Rising Coaches Conference. We have Buzz Williams on tonight, as well as some other great speakers and panelists. You still have time. Go to risingcoaches.com, sign up for a free trial, and get access to the conference. You won't want to miss it. Andy, again, thank you so much for being with us, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Bye-bye.
What's up, podcast fans? I want to share some information about one of our partners, Lucio Sports. The team at Lucio has built an integrated platform of coaching, productivity, and player development apps that are being used by some of the best basketball programs around the globe, helping everyone from NBA champions to youth development academies. Their innovative and competitive memorization games make it so much easier for new players and staff members to remotely get caught up to speed. With animated playbooks, drill libraries, player development planning and monitoring, engaging game plans and scouting reports, predictive play drawing, their content services team, and more, Lucio Sports has got you covered. From players to coaches to support staff and executives, use Lucio Sports to securely keep everyone in your organization on the same page with simple on-demand access to your team's entire knowledge base. For more information, check out luciosports.com. That's LUCEO sports.com.